Welcome to Southern Solitudes. Tonight, I have two guests from the same small southern town, Jake Blount and Mick Kelly. Good to have you both here.
Good to be summer come for once.
Thanks for having us.
Jake, let's start with you. You're working at the carnival right now. What is it like day to day?
It's loud, dirty. I run a booth and I watch people come in all day. Mostly mill workers and their families. They're exhausted, they have almost no money, and they spend what little they have on nothing. And I'm standing right there, taking it from them. It bothers me more than I can say.
You talk to any of them? Try to tell them what you think?
I mean, I try, but I come on too strong, and I know that. People back away, or they think I'm just some drunk with crazy ideas. So mostly, I end up at Singer's room at night.
Singer, the deaf man at your boarding house? You go talk to him, even though he can't hear you?
I know how it sounds, but he sits there and watches me and nods, and I feel like someone is actually receiving what I'm saying. I leave his room feeling less like about to explode. That counts for a lot.
Mick, same thing. You visit Singer too. What do you get from him?
What I get? He has a gift. He can make you feel like you exist. Like what's going on inside you is real and worth something. Like you're worth listening to. I don't get that feeling in many other places.
What have you been up to lately? How do you occupy yourself?
Well, I built this violin out of scrap and some wire. It's either this or I wouldn't get to play any instruments at all. That way, maybe I could play some of the music I hear in my head. Although, the sound of the violin is terrible. Regardless, I still play it from time to time. Better than nothing, I guess.
But wasn't there something with your brother, Bubber, that happened earlier this week?
There was an accident. I don't really want to get into it, but it was bad. It happened so fast, and I tried to tell Bubber not to play with the loaded gun, but he wouldn't listen. Then the worst happened, and I wish I reacted better at the time. I still can't get the image of baby on the floor with blood. The thought of it gives me nightmares.
I'm so sorry. How did it make you feel? How have you been handling everything that has happened?
It made everything feel heavier. There's this space inside me where I keep the music, where I think about the future. And after that, it got smaller. The outside stuff kept pushing in. That's how I got it to get my consciousness to feel lighter.
You have to fight to keep that space. Once it's gone, it's very hard to get back.
Is that what happened to you?
Maybe, yeah.
Jake, let's talk about that. The drinking, the anger. You're aware it's a problem.
I'm completely aware. The anger comes from the right place. I really do believe the system is broken and workers are being crushed by it. But by the time it comes out of me, it's all twisted up with the frustration and the alcohol and just pushes people away. And I'm alone again with all of it.
So Singer is really the only one who gets the real version of what you think?
The only one who sits still long enough, yeah.
When was the last time you repeated your pattern of drinking and speaking of your ideas?
Last night. Same as most nights, I guess. I get a few drinks in me and suddenly everything feels louder. Like the thoughts won't stay put unless I say them out loud. It's like pressure building up all day and talking is the only way to let it out. I used to think it helped me make sense of things, but now it just feels like I'm repeating myself, chasing the same idea and never quite getting there.
Last question for both of you. What do you actually want for yourselves?
I mean, I want to say what I mean in a way that reaches people, just once, to feel like the truth I'm carrying actually landed somewhere.
I want to write real music, something completely mine, and I want someone to hear it and feel something, make people feel how music has always made me feel.
Okay, an echo and a song. This concludes tonight's episode of Southern Solitude. Stay tuned for more episodes every night. Thank you both. Mick, Jake, good night.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you for the invite. See y'all.
You're listening to Southern Solitudes. I'm Stella, And today we move into the winter heart of Carson McCullough's The Heart is a Lonely Hunter. In part 2, chapter 6 and 7, Christmas descends on a small Georgia town, bringing both light and loneliness. To help us explore these chapters, we have the author herself, Carson McCullough's, and historian Dr. Lewis Grant. Together, we'll revisit Dr. Copeland's Christmas gathering, the quiet generosity of Mr. Singer, and what the season reveals about race and solitude in the American South. Before we begin, here's a brief outline of what unfolds. Dr. Benedict Copeland, the black physician, who's devoted his life to lifting his people, hosts a Christmas dinner for his family, a rare gathering full of tension and love. Meanwhile, across town, John Singer, the silent lodger at the Kelly's boarding house, spends the day preparing thoughtful gifts for his friends who orbit his calm presence.
It's Christmas Eve. The Copeland homes glows dimly under a flickering lamp. Dr. Copeland, tall, commanding, a man shaped by years of study and hope, has cooked a feast. He waits for his children, though their relationship has grown distant. When they arrive, the house fills with sound, laughter, gospel sounds, the rustle of coats hung by the door. For a moment, the good doctor smiles, but when he begins to talk of progress, of his dream that his children fight for justice, the air chills. One by one, they glance away. His daughter Portia murmurs gently that the world cannot change overnight. His sons avoid his eyes, unwilling to hear a sermon on a night meant for joy. The old doctor sets down his fork. "My children," he says softly, "I wanted this night to be a communion, but we are apart, even here together."
That moment, it pierces the reader. Carson, what were you showing through that family gathering?
It's a portrait of ideals clashing with fatigue. Dr. Copeland's family loves him, but they can't live up to his expectation. The dinner turns from celebration to quiet disappointment, like so many human attempts at closeness.
And it also mirrors the larger reality of African-American life in the segregated schools. Dr. Copeland's education and intellect set him apart from both white society and his own community. He's a man who says beyond his time, but that vision isolates him.
That tension surfaces again when a student wins the high school essay prize, doesn't it?
Exactly. A young black student wins a regional context. Yet, the award must be presented separately from the white student ceremony. It's a symbolic humiliation. Dr. Copeland sees it as a knife twist, proof that progress remains surface deep.
I wrote that scene to show how achievement is shadowed by injustice. Even when success appears, dignity is stolen bit by bit.
On Christmas morning, in his small rented room, John Singer lays out neat row of packages. He cannot hear the church bells ring outside, but he feels them, faint tremors throughout the window pane. For Mick Kelly, the tomboy girl who loves music, a small radio. For Jake Blount, a sharp cigar case. And for Dr. Copeland, a fine book of essays. He wraps each gift carefully, his movements precise and tender. No words, only gestures, the purest language he possesses. And as he delivers them, his friends each feel seen, if only for a moment. But when he returns to his empty room, the warmth fades. He sits beside the photograph of his absent friend, Antonopoulos, and his hand rests still upon his knees. It's as if Christmas has ended before it began. There's something heartbreaking about Singer's silence. Carson, what does his giving represent?
It's his way of speaking love. Every gift carries unspoken devotion. But because he lives within silence, literal and emotional, every connection slipped through his fingers. That's what I felt about loneliness. It's not about absence of people, it's the failure of understanding.
And those gifts link the characters, the doctor, the dreamer, the worker, the child, all separate, yet orbiting this quiet man?
It's almost biblical in theme. The mute messenger bringing grace. At the same time, McCullough plays this in the racial and economic division of the 1930s South. Every act of kindness occurs under the shadow of inequality.
That makes these Christmas moments both universal and situational, tenderness surviving in a broken social order. So, in these two chapters, we see the town illuminated for one night. There's music, food, laughter, gifts. But behind the smiles, McCullough shows us what binds the lonely together, the wish to be known.
Yes, the true heart of the story isn't despair, but endurance, that even the lonely still reach out.
And in the South of the 1930s, that reaching was radical, to hope, to love across boundaries. Those were acts of quiet courage.
Thank you, Carson McCullers and Dr. Lewis Grant, for sharing this night reflection. To our listeners, may the spirit of understanding find a place in your own homes, however distant they may feel. I'm Stella, and this has been Southern Solitudes. Good night from us all.